Only the sound of the idling engine broke the stillness. The joy which had transformed our faces these last few days slowly faded as our anxiety grew. A few voices cursed our bad luck. I thought that by now we were good and far from any trouble. God damn it. What do you think it could be? Partisans, muttered Hals, who had already taken part in a manhunt. There were several other conjectures as well. Whoever they are, I'm not going to let the bastards wreck my leave. I wonder what we are waiting for. Why don't they just tell us to go ahead and shoot them? Each of us had already picked up the Morza which soldiers on leave in an occupied country were required to carry at all times. The idea that somebody or something might prevent us from going home made us feel savage. We were ready to shoot anyone at a moment's notice if that's what was needed to keep moving west. But the order to fire never came. The Feld climbed back onto his truck, and the convoy started off again. We stared at each other in confusion. When, some 500 yards further on, we ran into a group of 20 German officers carrying shotguns, we felt so surprised and delighted that our assumption had been mistaken that we cheered them as if we were driving past the Führer himself. At last, we reached Niedrigweilhof, where we left the convoy, which turned south. We went on to Romy, the gypsy paradise, where we were supposed to be picked up by another convoy moving west. At Niedrigweilhof, our ranks were swelled by other men on leave from various parts of Russia, until there were nearly 1,000 of us. However, the supply of available trucks had to be used for many purposes other than simply transporting men on leave. The few trucks for Romy took on about 20 fortunate souls. The rest of us were left to mill about in front of a field kitchen equipped to feed barely a quarter of our number. Although we were famished, we decided to walk the 30 miles to Romy, and set off despite the lateness of the hour, in the best of spirits. About 20 fellows who were considerably older than the rest of us and belonged to the Grossdeutschland division came along. There were also 7 or 8 fellows from the SS, who sang at the tops of their lungs. The others took swigs from bottles which they passed from hand to hand. They must have emptied several cellars. Every one of them seemed to be carrying a generous collection. We had instinctively arranged ourselves in threes, as if we were going up to the line, and were proceeding on the double, consciously reducing the distance which separated us from Romy. Evening was slowly falling across the endless green, rolling landscape. Our uniforms, so perfectly matched to outdoor colors, seemed to take on the tone of the surrounding landscape, like chameleon skins. After the first 10 miles, our high spirits faded somewhat, leaving us more inclined to contemplate the immense panorama of the Ukraine. The earth, engaged in the processes of spring germination, exhaled a subtle but nonetheless powerful odor, as the horizon faded into the boundless emptiness of the darkening sky. Our uniforms grew darker as the earth darkened, almost as if by magic, and our footsteps seemed to be setting the rhythm of the whole mysterious universe. The blackness of night was spreading behind us, and we fell silent, hushed by the respect which immensity imposes on simple men. Our group of soldiers, members of an army hated throughout the world, was seized by an indefinable emotion. As one sometimes jokes to hide sadness, we began to sing to avoid thought. The favorite song of the SS rose up like a hymn to the earth, offered to men, so we eit die braune Heidjet, gehort das Elsewhere. Then darkness engulfed us, a darkness which, for the first time in months, seemed made for nothing more than watching over us. Although we had begun to feel our exhaustion, no one suggested a halt. The road home was long, and we didn't want to lose any time. For me, hoping to reach my other country, the road was even longer. Although our leave did not officially begin until Poznan, the idea of getting home overrode every other consideration, and enabled me to endure painful condition of my bare feet, rubbed raw by my boots. Hals, who was having the same sort of trouble, cursed the storekeeper at Iktika for failing to supply us with socks. After about 20 miles, we were forced to reduce our speed. Naturally, the veterans who had joined us, and whose feet must have been made of iron, treated us like crybabies. But they gave us their own socks, so that we could go on. For a few of us, however, this was not enough. Our feet were too lacerated, and the 3 additional miles we were able to manage cost us too much pain. As the rest of the group kept on despite our cries pleading for a halt, we decided to try walking barefoot on the dewy grass. At first, this seemed like an improvement, but not for long. Some even thought of wrapping their feet in the new undershirts we had been issued, but the possibility of an inspection made them hesitate. The last few miles, as we hobbled through the growing daylight, were torturified by the first military police we met on the outskirts of Romy, who made us put back our boots. They said they wouldn't allow us into town looking like a bunch of tramps. We couldn't have murdered them. Further on, we asked some gypsies to take the worst cases as far as the commandanture in their carts. They were prudent enough not to argue. The infirmary was in the same building as the commandanture. We even spoke with the commandant, who was outraged that soldiers from the Grossdeutschland should have to go without socks. He sent an official statement of indignation to the Ektika camp for failing to provide properly for new troops. Those who wished medical attention were sent to the infirmary, where their feet were washed in basins of warm water to which chloroform had been added. This had an extraordinary effect, easing our pain almost at once. We were each given a small red metal box of cream for coating our feet before setting out on a march. But we still had no socks. Those of our group who had not gone to the infirmary were looking into the prospects for the rest of our journey. The Kharkiv-Kiev line ran through Romy, with daily trains in both directions. Our disappointment therefore was great when our 2 Feldwebels announced that we wouldn't be leaving for at least 2 days. All available space on trains moving toward the front was reserved for essentials, and on returning trains emergencies were given priority over soldiers on leave. Rumors multiplied among our group of 500 anxious men for whom each hour counted. People spoke of leaving for Kiev on their own, thumbing a ride on one of the convoys, or sneaking onto a train on the quiet, or stealing some Russian horses. Some even spoke of doing the journey on foot 150 miles, which would take at least 5 days, even with forced marches. As all of these were really out of the question, we decided it would be better simply to stay where we were. Old Hans groaned, "I can tell you, we'll just sit here and watch our passes expire. We've got to get out of here. Who says we'll leave in 2 days? We'll probably be right where we are a week from now, so fuck the whole damn mess, I'm clearing out." My feet were still feeling too sensitive even to think about a march, no matter how pressing it might be. Hals and Lenten were in the same state. So, for better or for worse, we had to wait in Romy without any idea of what to do, or even where to sleep. The police were always after us, telling us to move on. It was useless to try to explain to them the bastards weren't interested. In the Ukraine, that paradise for troops on leave, they had rediscovered all the exasperating authority they exercised in peacetime. Anyone rash enough to argue with them risked having his pass torn up in front of his eyes. We saw this happen to one poor devil about 40 years old. The gendarmes kicked his pack like some kind of football, and the fellow remarked in an angry voice that he had just spent 6 months fighting in the Caucasus, and felt entitled to a certain amount of common courtesy. "Traitors!" shouted one of the horrible cops. "Traitors who ran away from the Russians and lost Rostov? They should send the whole lot of you back to the front, which you never should have left in the first place." And he ripped the poor man's pass into shreds before his horrified eyes. We thought he would break down and howl. Instead, he threw himself on the 2 cops, knocking both of them flat. He was gone before we could recover from our stupefaction. The furious cops picked themselves up, swearing to have the man shot. We took ourselves off in a hurry, before they had the chance to turn their guns on us. 2 days later, we left for Kiev after all, crammed into a train which was also loaded with cattle. But we didn't care about traveling in comfort. We were interested only in getting to Kiev, which several months before its destruction was still a beautiful city. In Kiev, we felt that we had been saved, that the war no longer existed. The city looked beautiful, and was full of flowers. People were going quietly about their ordinary, everyday occupations. White street cars edged in red moved through the brightly dressed civilian crowds of the pleasant town. Everywhere, troops in trim, brushed uniforms were walking with Ukrainian girls. I had already liked the look of the town in the winter. Now all my agreeable impressions were confirmed. I would gladly have ended the war right there. From Kiev, we had no trouble finding a train leaving for Poland. Our journey was vivid and colorful. We left in a crowded civilian train and, mixed in this way with ordinary Russian people, had more of a chance to become acquainted with them than at any time during the war. Our train of oddly assorted carriages rolled for hours along a track that crossed the empty expanse of the Pripyat marshes. The Russians, who drank and sang non-stop, offered drinks to all the soldiers too, and the noise throughout the journey was almost beyond belief. At the occasional station stops, people got on and off, and the most outrageous jokes were cracked amid shouts of laughter. The women made even more noise than the men. Hals put on a gorharichka for a short time. We passed in this way from the Ukraine into Poland, arriving after 2.5 days in Lublin, where we had to change trains. At Lublin there was also a meticulous police inspection, and we were ordered to go to the camp barber for haircuts before departure. However, our anxiety about missing the train was so great that we decided to take what seemed like an enormous risk, which succeeded. Hals, Lenson, and I managed to walk out past the military police with our hair untouched by any shears. This proved to have been a risk well worth taking, as without it we would surely have missed the train. We arrived at Poznan in the middle of the night, and were received by a very efficient center. We were given tickets for the canteen and the dormitory, and told to be at the office in the morning to have our passes validated. The office was open from 7 to 11, but we were warned to be there no later than 6, as there was usually a queue. This struck us as somewhat strange. In effect, it meant that troops arriving in Poznan at 11:05 in the morning had to wait until the following day before they could continue their journey. I think this arrangement was probably motivated by a desire to keep men under army control even when they were theoretically on leave. In this way, a cancellation order could be sent east while the troops were waiting. By contrast, the office which processed returning troops was open 24 hours a day. We spent what was left of the night in a comfortable dormitory which reminded me of the barracks at Chemnitz, and were at the office for passes by 6 the next morning. There were already some 20 men ahead of us, who must have spent the night on the spot, and by 7 there must have been at least 300. The self-important bureaucrats who ran the place took their own time verifying our documents, while we stood in agitated silence. The police standing by the door were ready to cancel the leave of anyone foolish enough to lose his temper. When our papers had been stamped, we were sent across the courtyard into a large hall where our uniforms were inspected. We were given the opportunity to polish our boots and brush our clothes beforehand, and one might almost have believed that there was no mud in Russia. Then, a final, charming detail, women soldiers distributed packages of choice foods wrapped in paper covered with eagles and swastikas, and inscribed, "A happy holiday to our brave soldiers. Sweet, sensitive Germany." Hals, who would have been capable of killing himself for a cup of beef broth, rolled enormous eyes. If we'd only had something like this at Kharkov. We felt profoundly moved by these attentions. A package of sausages, jam, and cigarettes seemed generous repayment for our endless nights in the stone-cracking cold, and our wanderings through the mud of the Don Valley. Hals and I set off for Berlin, bearing our gifts. Lenson left us to travel to his native Prussia. In Berlin, we were once again reminded of the war's existence. Around the Silesian station, and in the Weissensee and Pankow districts, many buildings had been reduced to rubble, in the first stages of the city's destruction. But otherwise the active, busy life of a capital metropolis went on as usual. In Berlin, which I was seeing for the first time, I was reminded of a promise I had made. I had promised myself to go see Snubuck's wife. She lived with his parents in the southern part of the city. I explained this to Hals, who advised me to postpone the obligation until my return trip. But I knew very well that I would never be able to bring myself to leave home a day early, and that my parents would try to hang on to me until the last moment. Hals understood this, even though he tried to persuade me to do something else. He didn't want to lose any time either, and left for Dortmund as soon as he could, making me promise to come to see him. I would have done better to listen to the voice of wisdom, speaking through my friend. My journey came to an end the next day, in the flames of Magdeburg, and I had to stay in Berlin, a city entirely unknown to me, where I had to work hard to make myself understood. Still carrying my pack and gun, which were beginning to feel very heavy, I set out to try to find the Snubuck's house. Fortunately, I was still able to read the scribbled address I had found among my poor friend's papers. But should I try to get there by subway, or by bus? As I really didn't know where I was going, I decided to proceed on foot, which would at least give me the chance to look around. The idea of walking across the city still seemed normal at that time. However, I didn't want to stray too far afield, to walk west when I should have been walking south. I had noticed a sign, Berlin Sud, which must be roughly correct. I passed two cops who gave me a long, cold stare when they noticed the spectacular package of a soldier on leave. I saluted them as required. One had to salute those bastards as if they were army officers and went on my way. The city seemed beautiful, but serious and well organized. The bombing had only recently begun, and in Berlin affected only the districts immediately around the railway stations. In this large, imposing town, with its austere houses set off by sumptuous, intricate railings, everything seemed to be regulated by a precise, organized rhythm, no raucous crowds or parents pulling down their children's pants to let them pee. Men, women, children, bicycles, cars, and trucks all seemed to be moving at an even, regular pace toward a precise destination, with a rhythm that seemed conscious and assertive, and designed to avoid any dissipation of energy. It was all very different from Paris, for example. Undue haste seemed out of place, and my legs seemed to fall instinctively into the accepted tempo of the city. To stop moving without good reason would have seemed strange. The huge machine which the regime had set in motion for the cause was turning, and this was evident even in the gestures of the little old lady who was walking just ahead of me, and whom I stopped to ask for directions. Her neat white hair was impeccable, like the streets and the railings and the edges of the sidewalks. The sound of my voice seemed to call her back from some distant daydream. "Excuse me, gnädige Frau," I said, feeling somewhat embarrassed, as if I were speaking in a theater where the play had already begun. "Could you give me some directions? I am going to this address." I showed her my scrap of paper, which really looked like something pulled out of a waste paper basket. The old lady smiled, as if she had seen an angel. "It's very far, young man," she said in a gentle voice which suddenly reminded me of my childhood. "It's very far. You must go to the Tempelhof Autobahn. But it's really very far. That doesn't matter." I couldn't think of anything else to say. "You really ought to take a bus. It would be much easier for you." "That doesn't matter," I repeated, like someone in a dream. In fact, I couldn't think of the German words for anything else. This woman's obvious goodness, after so much loud-mouthed bullying and malignity, moved me even more deeply than the exhausted men at Auchenne. "I don't mind walking. I'm in the infantry," I finally said, smiling. "I know," she said, smiling even more tenderly than a moment before. "You must be used to walking. I'll go with you as far as the Schloss von Kaiser Wilhelm. From there, I'll be able to explain to you." She walked along beside me. As I didn't know what to say, the burden of the conversation fell on her. "Where have you come from, young man?"
"From Russia."
"Russia's a big country. What part were you in?"
"Russia's very big, yes. I was in the south, around Kharkov.
Kharkov? She said, giving the name a very German sound. I see. Is it a big town? Yes. It's big. For my kindly companion, Kharkov was clearly nothing more than a name which there was no particular need to remember. For me, Kharkov meant a city which had lost its life. If it had ever been a big town, it was now only a heap of rubble, crowned by a cloud of dust, smoke, and fire. It was also the sound of cries and moaning one shouldn't hear in towns. It was a long corridor of stiffened corpses we had to drag out into the air, and three Bolsheviks tied to a fence, with their guts spilling from their bellies. My son is in Bryansk, the old lady remarked, clearly hoping for news of the front. Bryansk, I repeated in a thoughtful tone. I believe that's in the central sector. I've never been there. He tells me that everything's going quite well. He's a first lieutenant in an armored division. A lieutenant, I thought. An officer. The opinions of a private soldier must have sounded ridiculous. Were things difficult in your sector? Things were pretty hard, but they're better now. I'm on leave, I added, smiling. I'm really happy for you, young man, she said, and her voice sounded as if she meant it. Are you in Berlin to see your family? No, gnädige Frau. I'm going to see the parents of a friend. A friend. Ernst. A corpse. What friend was I tramping along like this for? The old woman was beginning to get on my nerves. A friend from your regiment, she said, sharing my pleasure at being on leave. I felt like knocking her onto one of those intricate railings full of spikes. Where do your parents come from? She asked. From Wissembourg, in Alsace. She looked at me with surprise. So you're Alsatian. I know Alsace very well. I almost told her that she knew it better than I did. Yes, I'm Alsatian, I said, hoping to get a little peace. She began to tell me about a trip she'd taken to Strasbourg, but I wasn't listening anymore. By forcing me to remember Ernst, she had irritated me. I had better things to do than listen to this old bird reminisce about her travels. It was a beautiful day, I was on leave, and I needed to see something gay. This desire made me wonder what attitude to take when I got to the Nubucks. These people had just lost their son, and were probably overwhelmed by grief. Maybe they didn't even know he was dead. If that's how it was, what on earth could I say to them? It would be better to visit them on my way back. By then, they would surely have been told. Hals was right. I should have listened to him. He, at least, was still alive. We came to a crossroad opposite a bridge over a stream or even perhaps a large river. I knew that the Seine flowed through Paris, but couldn't have said whether Berlin was on the Elbe or the Oder. To the right, there was a massive block of buildings, the Schloss von Kaiser Wilhelm, and directly across the avenue an impressive memorial to the heroes of 1914-18. 1200 helmets of that time set round a forecourt, to give some idea of the sacrifice. Two sentries from Hitler's guard walked slowly back and forth along a cement apron at the base of the monument. Their slow, even pace seemed to me strangely symbolic of a human being's slow progress toward eternity. With a regularity which a master watchmaker might well have envied, the two men executed impeccably synchronized half-turns, faced each other at a distance of about 30 meters, resumed their march, crossed, turned, and began again. I found this spectacle somehow oppressive. Here we are, young man, the old woman said. You cross the bridge and follow that avenue. She pointed toward the vast, stony backdrop of the city, in which I would have to find my address. But I had already stopped listening. I knew that I wasn't going to the Nubucks, and that these explanations were superfluous. Nevertheless, I outdid myself in expressions of gratitude, and pressed the old lady's hand. She withdrew, repeating her protestations of goodwill. I couldn't help smiling. As soon as she had disappeared, I rushed back in the direction from which we'd come, trying to make up for lost time, and find the station for the west as quickly as possible. I walked along the riverbank with the obsessive speed of a maniac. Suddenly, the air filled with martial music, and an elegantly dressed military band marched out through a tall gateway, and turned into the street. I remembered what we were taught at Bierwistok, and snapped to attention, presenting arms to the indifferent troop. After an hour and a half, with innumerable stops to ask my way, I arrived at the station from which trains left for the West, and France. I looked desperately for Hals amid the throngs on the platform. He would surely be on this train too, but I couldn't find him in the few minutes before departure. As I caught my breath on the train, the slow regular progress of our acceleration seemed to merge with the measured tempo of the German capital. Everything here was so entirely different from Russia. Even the soldiers had an air of seriousness which matched the civilized, organized life of all large European countries. The contrast with Russia was so great that I wondered if what I seen there wasn't part of a bad dream. Night fell, and the train rolled on. We had been moving for at least 3 hours, during which it seemed that we had never left the city. There was no countryside, only buildings. Suddenly, the train came to a stop, although we were not in a station. Everyone leaned out the windows to see what was happening. Although it was dark, the distant sky glowed with red light. We could hear a muffled rumbling, mingled with the boom of guns. The throbbing of a mass of airplanes overhead rattled the windows of the train. "That must be Magdeburg, getting it in the neck," said a soldier who had shoved in beside me to look out too. "Who's giving it to them?" I asked. He looked at me curiously. "Those Yankee bastards, of course," he said, as if he were talking to a simpleton. "Things are just as hot here as they are at the front." I couldn't tear my eyes away from the glow of the burning city. I had thought that we'd left the war far behind us. The train began to move again, only to come to a fresh halt 15 minutes later. Soldiers ran up the track, calling everybody off. Somebody said that the line had been cut, and that all military personnel, whether on active duty or on leave, had to put themselves at the disposal of the local authorities. Thus I found myself, in my clean uniform and carrying my holiday package, falling into step with about 100 resigned soldiers. We walked for about half an hour into the blinding, acrid smoke of countless fires, and began shifting fallen timbers and massive masonry blocks, while delayed action bombs pulverized what was left of a terrified bourgeois population. Groups of whimpering civilians were impressed into clean-up squads by foul-mouthed officials shouting at the tops of their lungs. Everyone was put to work. Although it was pitch dark, we were able to see broken gas pipes thrown up onto the torn earth blazed like blowtorches, amid the heaps of stones, broken wood, window glass, furniture, arms, and legs. A gang of territorials handed out picks, and we piled the rest of our equipment beside a fire truck. We had to dig into the ruins with the greatest possible speed. We could hear the groans and cries of people trapped in the cellars. Women and children weeping with terror were carting away bricks and stones to clear some space. Shouted orders overlapped. "Quick! This way! We need help over here! Quick! The water pipes have burst and are flooding the cellars." Of course, the military were chosen to deal with the most dangerous situations, and sent into places threatened with immediate collapse. We reached the cellars through the deep air shafts. We attacked a brick wall which seemed to be blocking the entrance to a basement where people were calling for help. My pick sank into something soft, probably the stomach of some poor soul crushed by the debris. And damn it, I was on leave, and all of this was holding me up. An explosion shifted the ground we were standing on, another one of those American bombs which blow up some time after they've landed. Nonetheless, our efforts were finally successful. The last brick wall fell beneath our blows, and a bunch of haggard, blackened people surged through the jagged opening, engulfed in a swirling cloud of dust. Several people embraced us, sobbing with relief and recognition. Others were in a state of literal madness. Everyone was somehow hurt or wounded. We had to climb down ourselves to bring out terrified women clutching their children so tightly they were nearly suffocating them. I pulled out the first child I saw. A kid of about 5 was tugging at one of my trouser legs so hard that it came right out of my boot. He was trying to drag me to a particular spot, and he was crying so hard that his gasps for breath between each sob were extraordinarily long.